Good morning, everybody. It's very good to be here. My talk today is about some of the changes taking place in the financing of the Australian economy. After 15 years of rapid growth, credit has been growing at a much more subdued pace over the past couple of years. In fact, for the first time since the early 1990s, banks are finding that credit is now growing more slowly than deposits, with the result that banks are able to repay funds previously borrowed in wholesale markets, including from offshore. These developments have been associated with a noticeable increase in national saving and a marked reduction in the current account deficit. And I want to spend some time today talking about these developments. I'll start, though, with a few general observations about credit. Over the very long run, money and credit in most economies tend to grow somewhat faster than GDP. This is part of the financial deepening that occurs as economies develop and as incomes grow. Since 1960, for example, credit in Australia has increased on average by about 12.5% a year, while GDP in nominal terms has increased on average by about 9%. Over shorter periods, however, credit shows pronounced cycles. During periods when optimism is high, households and businesses tend to increase their use of credit, often for the acquisition of assets. At other times, typically in the wake of economic downturns, borrowers can become very conservative and cut back on their demand for credit. Lenders, too, can become much more cautious at these times. The most recent cycle in credit began in the mid-1990s and extended through to the years leading up to the global financial crisis. Most of that period involved an expansion in household credit. Financial deregulation and innovation greatly increased the supply of credit, and the fall in interest rates that accompanied the fall in inflation in the 1990s gave households greater capacity to borrow. The rapid expansion in household debt that followed was not unique to Australia, and as you know, our most developed economies experienced sharp rises in household indebtedness over that period. Most of this expansion in household credit, both in Australia and offshore, was used to buy houses, and not surprisingly, house prices rose a lot over that period. In many countries, the marked expansion in housing credit went on to cause severe financial difficulties. Here in Australia, however, this has not happened, and in particular, housing loan arrears remain relatively low. Contributing to this better outcome in Australia was the fact that the deterioration in lending standards was not as severe or as widespread as in other countries. Also, household incomes have continued to grow strongly in Australia, in the context of a strong economy and low unemployment. However, within this overall picture of resilience, there are, as always, pockets of housing stress. In the early part of the last decade, those pockets were heavily concentrated in the southwest parts of Sydney. These problems followed the very strong rises in Sydney house prices over 2002 and into 2003, and they were linked to the very sharp rise in loan approvals, some lowering of credit standards, particularly by second-tier lenders, and increased speculative activity. Conditions in that region subsequently improved, helped by a period of stable house prices and rising incomes, though the process took a long time, and the arrears rate in that part of Sydney, even today, remains higher than the national average. Recently, it's been parts of Queensland and Western Australia that have shown a deterioration in loan arrears, albeit from quite low levels. As had been the case in Sydney earlier in the decade, the recent increase in loan arrears in these states followed a sharp increase in housing loans and unusually strong rises in house prices between 2006 and 2008. Now, some part of this was justified by the emerging resources boom. But as had occurred in Sydney earlier, This was accompanied by some lowering of credit standards and again increased speculative activity, and with the result that some households overextended themselves. Adding to the stress in household finances was the fact that in both these states, the rise in unemployment through 2009 was higher than average, again though from relatively low levels. Another potential source of vulnerability in the housing market that people often talk about is the many first homeowners who were attracted into the housing market in 2009 by the increase in the first homeowner grant. The concern is that these, some of these at least, may have overcommitted themselves financially in order to enter the market and are now vulnerable to rising interest rates. This group bears close watching, but so far at least, first homeowners do not seem to be disproportionately represented in loan arrears. While the household sector as a whole continues to show a good deal of resilience in meeting loan repayments, the increase in indebtedness over the past 15 years does mean that households are now significantly more sensitive to changes in interest rates. The proportion of household income devoted to servicing debt is relatively high, even though housing interest rates are only a little above average. It's not surprising, therefore, that households have become more cautious. Household saving increased markedly in the wake of the global financial crisis and has remained high in the face of continuing problems in European financial markets and rising global inflationary pressures. In the current environment, it's unlikely that households will have much enthusiasm for increased borrowing. The most likely scenario is that household borrowing will continue to grow at a relatively subdued pace for some time yet. From the Reserve Bank's perspective, this would be a welcome development. It would allow the period of consolidation in household balance sheets to continue, and it would avoid households adding to pressures in the economy at a time when its productive capacity is already being stretched by the resources boom. While most of the growth in credit in the lead-up to the global financial crisis was driven by households, a substantial increase in business credit also occurred in the years immediately before the crisis. This expansion in lending was mainly to large businesses and, while some of it was used to fund real investment, a substantial amount was for financial activity. Now, as often happens during a credit boom, a disproportionate amount of the lending that took place over that period came from second-tier lenders. Business credit provided by foreign banks, for example, rose by about 80% between 2006 and 2008. While business credit provided by regional banks rose by about 60%. A lot of this was directed to commercial property. Since the global financial crisis, the inevitable correction has occurred. Business credit has fallen, and those lenders that expanded the most have since contracted the most. Similarly, sectors such as commercial property that increased gearing the most have since experienced the sharpest increase in problem loans and the sharpest contraction in credit. Now, through all this, a credit to small business, to the small business sector has been much more stable. It increased by less through the boom, and it has continued to expand since the crisis, although at a slow rate. It's not unusual for business credit to be subdued for a time following a period of strong expansion. Both supply and demand usually contribute to this. For instance, businesses often look to repay debt in order to repair balance sheets that had become stretched during the boom. Also, lenders that had expanded strongly during the boom often end up making significant amounts of bad loans, and when this becomes apparent to them, they respond by cutting back sharply on new loans. Normally, periods of soft business credit are associated with periods of soft business investment. What is somewhat unusual about the current softness in business credit is that it is occurring at a time when business investment is very high. Now, this unusual conjuncture arises largely from the fact that the strength of investment at present is concentrated in the resources sector, and is being funded mainly by the large amounts of cash that resource companies are generating from existing activities. As a result, despite the very high levels of business investment, there has not been a need to resort to substantial borrowing. There are signs, however, that the low point in business credit growth is now behind us. Substantial repair has taken place in business balance sheets since the crisis. Business investment is still picking up, and the banking sector is showing more willingness to lend. On average, recent monthly figures for business credit have been somewhat stronger than earlier in the year. It would be normal for this pickup to continue over the next couple of years as the economic recovery strengthens and broadens. So what does this mean for bank funding? Well, during the period of rapid credit growth that began in the mid-1990s, bank balance sheets expanded rapidly. At the same time, deposit growth slowed, both because of the decline in national saving and a shift in household saving towards securities rather than deposits. With aggregate credit growing by 12.5% a year on average and deposits growing by 10.5% a year, banks were left with a noticeable funding gap. They filled this by borrowing in wholesale markets, including from offshore. Now, this funding model was well suited to the market conditions of the time. Banks had little difficulty in raising funds in wholesale markets due to the weight of money seeking to come to Australia. In fact, it could be argued that the whole dynamic was driven by this flow of offshore money wanting to come to Australia. That is, banks were offered ample amounts of funds by foreigners, which they in turn lent domestically, causing an increase in spending, a reduction in saving, a slowing in deposits, and a widening in the current account deficit. This is a situation not dissimilar to that faced by the United States over the past decade, which Federal Reserve's Chairman Bernanke has described in detail in his explanation of the global saving glut. Two things can go wrong in this environment. The first is that the weight of money can lead to an erosion of lending standards by banks as they try to find more and more borrowers. If this is severe enough, it will eventually lead to a financial crisis because loans are made that cannot be repaid. This is essentially what happened in the United States. As I noted, however, here in Australia, the reduction in lending standards was relatively slight in comparison. The second risk, which is the one that most people focus on, is that the flow of offshore money suddenly stops. The common presumption here is that there will then be a crisis because banks can no longer fund themselves. Now, people who worry about this usually do so as part of a broader concern about countries running current account deficits. This view of the world is not new. Its origins lie in the pre-1970s world of fixed exchange rates, since in that world, a cessation of capital inflow did quickly cause a crisis. This framework remains relevant for some emerging market economies which have relatively fixed exchange rates and unhedged foreign currency borrowings, but it is not well suited to analysing risks in mature economies with well-developed markets and in particular with floating exchange rates. Some people claim that the global financial crisis was a vindication of the view that offshore borrowing causes problems, but this misses the point that all banks were affected by the crisis, irrespective of whether they were borrowers or lenders in international markets. In fact, the Australian banks, which many see as being amongst the largest users of offshore markets, emerged from the crisis in better shape than most. Now, while they benefited from a temporary government guarantee, so too did banks in all other countries. Another point that's often missed in this debate is that if there is a sudden loss of offshore funding, other things also change due to the ensuing changes in market pricing and consumer and business behaviour. This allows the financial system to adjust. Now, for example, when the financial crisis hit, demand for credit here slowed sharply, private saving increased, particularly at the household level. This was accompanied by a narrowing in the gap in national saving, between national saving and investment, which, as you know, is a counterpart to the current account deficit. The latest figures show that the current account deficit's running now at an annual rate of only about 2%. Households also became more cautious, shifting their saving from investments in securities to bank deposits. Deposit growth is currently outpacing credit growth, allowing banks to reduce wholesale borrowings. And finally, capital flows into Australia did not cease, but they simply switched to more conservative investments, such as government bonds. The inflow of capital into government bonds during the past year has been more than sufficient to fund the current account deficit, and so has been accompanied by the private sector repaying offshore capital, particularly the banking sector doing that. The question that arises is what will happen to bank funding if, as expected, credit growth picks up again in the next few years? Specifically, will bank funding patterns return to the pre-crisis pattern? I think this seems unlikely at this stage. For one thing, credit growth is unlikely to return to pre-crisis rates in the foreseeable future, so pressures on bank funding are not going to be as severe as they were through that earlier period. Second, changes to supervisory rules and to market conditions have made pre-crisis funding patterns less attractive. In addition, if household saving continues at its recent higher level, it will sustain the growth of deposits. The household saving rate could, if anything, increase further. It's still below its historical highs, and strong growth in employment and income could provide the wherewithal for higher savings to coexist with steady growth in consumption. Also relevant will be the trends in non-bank capital inflows. If the current pattern of capital inflows continues, this too will add to deposit growth because these inflows eventually find their way into bank deposits. So all in all, it's likely that banks will be able to maintain the more conservative funding pattern that they have put in place recently. So let me sum up. The credit boom that began in the mid-1990s ended with the global financial crisis. The Australian financial system weathered that crisis better than most, and while the adjustment wasn't painless, the banking system remained resilient. It is currently transitioning through a period of slower growth. History tells us that periods of weak growth or weak credit growth, such as the one we're in at present, are relatively short-lived in a growing economy. So at some point, credit growth can be expected to pick up again. It would be wrong, however, to think that this means a return to the growth experienced in bank balance sheets in the period since the mid-1990s. That was an extraordinary period, driven by what was largely a one-off adjustment to household gearing following financial deregulation and the sustained fall in inflation and interest rates. In the economic climate likely to be faced by banks over the next few years, which is one of solid growth but cautious behaviour by households and generally low inflation, it would be reasonable to assume that the rate of credit growth will remain somewhere in the single-digit range. That rate of credit growth should be able to be matched by deposit growth, limiting the need for banks to raise funds in wholesale markets. Thank you very much.
Rick's happy to take questions.
Thank you, Rick. John Vay Wilson from Linmar Securities. The recent strength of the Australian dollar, I'd be interested to know what the bank's view on that is, and do you feel that it's being supported by a comparatively high interest rate regime, and is it in fact good for the economy long term?
I think most of the rise we've seen in the Australian dollar reflects what's happening to the global economy, which is the global economy is very strong and demand for resources which we produce is very high. The prices of those commodities is at record levels. And that's really the main thing that's driving it. Quite a number of countries that are resource producers have got very strong exchange rates at the moment. And what those countries are doing to interest rates doesn't seem to have that much effect on their exchange rates. Having said that, while the level of the dollar is largely understandable given what's happening to the world economy, we are conscious that some sectors of the economy find this level of exchange rate much more difficult. But that's something that's very hard to avoid.
Harold Shapiro. Rick, you talk about, or suggest that household savings will continue to increase. What is the impact, in your opinion, on consumer discretionary spending if that is the case?
Well, it's not clear what's going to happen to household savings. I mean, I'm saying it is possible. It's risen a lot in the last couple of years, but it's still not at record levels or anything. It could easily go higher. It depends on how consumers and households feel. If they continue to be cautious, they will continue to save a lot of the income that they're getting. And in general, that's probably good for the economy because, as I said, it limits the pressures on the economy at the moment that are coming from the resource development. Overall, high household saving or even slightly increased household saving doesn't necessarily mean there has to be weakness in consumption because the growth in employment and the growth in incomes will make it possible for consumption to increase even with household savings remaining high.
Peter Strachan from Stock Analysis. Just looking at a follow-on question really from Harold, housing pricing. We've seen over the last 30 years that occupancy rates for housing fall from about 3.1 per house to 2.5, 2.6 per house. The number of four-bedroom houses has risen from, like, I think, 17% 30 years ago to about 23, 24%. We're seeing house prices quite flat, somewhat over the last few years driven by high population immigration, population growth through immigration. Given those stats that, there's also 920,000 unoccupied dwellings in Australia. There is a force there for house prices to fall further. Would that be an unravelling event for the factors that you've previously mentioned in terms of stability of lending, borrowing?
Look, at the moment, most people feel there's a general shortage of housing in the economy, and I think that's right. And people are adjusting to the higher level of house prices relative to incomes. So you mentioned that we went for a couple of decades where the number of people per house was declining. That has been reversed lately. So the number of people in each house is actually going up. And I think people are doing that because the cost of housing has gone up and people are economising. That's part of the adjustment process. From where we sit, it would be a good outcome to have house prices relatively constant for a while incomes grow, and that would allow a better equilibrium between house prices and income, because I think most people feel that house prices are too high relative to incomes, even though in general the household sector has been able to afford this level of house prices. I think most people would prefer prices to be lower. How that interacts, nobody really knows how that will interact, but people have been forecasting a decline in Australian house prices for a long time, mainly on the back of the fact that house prices have fallen in most other countries around the world. But I think that sort of forecast doesn't really take into account the factors that are at work here in Australia, particularly the population growth and the fact that incomes are still rising. So house prices are adjusting relative to income here, not because house prices are falling, but because incomes are rising.
Rick, Rob Thomas, that's one of the most bullish outlooks I've heard from the Reserve Bank for quite a while. So banks don't have any issues on overseas funding and savings are going great and household populations rising, et cetera, et cetera. What risks can you see out there that worry you looking out a couple of years, if any?
There's always risks. But generally, at this stage of the economic cycle, we're at a stage of the cycle where the world economy is still gathering strength. That's going to be the dominant force of the world. In that environment, it would be normal to see inflationary pressures continue to rise in the globe. They're already, as you know, they're already rising. It's going to keep happening. That is likely to be accompanied by rises in global interest rates. Having said that, there's a lot of things wrong in the world. As you know, the people focusing a lot on the government debt situation in Europe. Nobody quite knows how that's going to work out. Could be quite messy. There's all sorts of issues around. Whether they come to anything, who knows? But, you know, the cycle at the moment is on an upswing.
Michael Whiting from Taylor Collison. The US debt situation, where some of the figures on $15 trillion worth of debt and what happens if interest rates start picking up there again and the percentage of GDP taken up by that repayment. Is that an issue that the Reserve Bank worries about?
Well, I think we share the general concern that many people have that, you know, government debt levels in the world are probably too high in many countries. It's a very difficult problem. Nobody quite knows what to do. Government debt is a very hard issue to deal with. You know, quite often in the past, when government debt has got to these levels, the result has been inflation because everything else has been too difficult. But for the moment, you know, there's a lot of debt around, but the really interesting thing is interest rates on government debt are still at very, very low levels. Somehow or other, people are still very happy to buy it.
Hi, Rick. John Keogh from the Financial Review again. Some market pundits are suggesting that there might be a bubble in commodity prices globally. I think even one of the Reserve Bank board members, Warwick McKibben, has raised somewhat of a similar concern, suggesting this might be fanned by low interest rates in the United States. What's your assessment of that situation, of the possibility of a commodity price bubble?
Well, the word bubble is a very emotive term. Look, there's no doubt that the world economy is very strong. Last year, the world economy grew by 5%. Every time the world economy grows by 5%, commodity prices rise. And the same thing is happening now. The unusual thing that's happening is that growth in the world economy is being driven by Asia. That's not something we've been used to. Most of the time in the post-war period, the world economic cycle has been determined by events in basically the United States or to some extent Europe. This time it's been driven by Asia. From all the work we've done, most of what we see in commodity prices today is driven by fundamental demand and supply factors. There's no doubt there's a bit of speculative activity as well, but fundamentally it's very strong demand that's driving this. How long it continues? No, I don't think anybody knows, and I wouldn't want to forecast. I mean, most people have been forecasting for the past year at least that commodity prices are going to come down. They keep going up. It's not clear they've even peaked yet.
Philip Lasker from ABC TV. I'm just wondering, it seems as though you're saying that the credit ratings agencies recently were wrong to downgrade our banks because of their reliance or their perceived reliance on wholesale funding down the track. They've been too trigger happy in that sense. It seems to me what you're saying. It seems to me you're also saying that that the banks will have no excuse to raise interest rates beyond any official increase for funding cost reasons going ahead, that their funding cost pressures have peaked. And I'm also interested in getting a view on the extent to which the household sector acts as a counterweight to any pressure on interest rates in the future. Is it a major factor in your deliberations, or is it going to be well and truly swamped by what's happening in the mining sector, and is it, in a sense, insignificant to that?
Okay. Well, on the credit rating agencies, look, I think the main point I'd make about that is that the credit rating agencies are still rating Australian banks at very high levels. Now, you can argue whether they should have made these recent reductions. My own personal view is that the risks that they're worrying about are risks that were in the past, and I think the situation's already changing. I've always felt that the risks that people point to in offshore borrowings are often overstated because people don't really understand how the Australian banks are managing those risks. The crucial point is that those offshore borrowings are all hedged back to Australian dollars and they're used to fund Australian dollar investments. That makes the banks very prudent in the way they run that. On the consumption and or household sector, you know, if the general proposition is that the economy can only grow at a certain rate, let's say, 3.5-4% before inflation starts to rise, and you've got very strong resource demand that's contributing a lot of that growth, it's pretty clear that other parts of demand, such as consumption and even housing, have to remain relatively subdued to fit within that overall growth rate. Now, that's what's been happening over the past year or so. As I say, I think that's, from our point of view, that's quite a favourable development. It doesn't mean that household consumption's going backwards. It just means it's growing at a very moderate pace. I think from where we sit, we'd like to see that continue.
Alan Hill from State One in Perth, also known as the home of the Mega Mansion. I'm interested in Mr. Bradley's comments about perhaps an under-reliance on consumption-based taxes. Just wondered whether you considered where there's a misallocation of resources due to the privileged tax position of the family home. It seems to me that this is causing an over-investment. Higher prices has ramifications right across the economy from young couple starting out right through to the amount of tax that you collect. So that's the one point I wanted to make. And the other question was, how would the Australian economy look if iron ore is back at, say, $60 a tonne?
Well, on housing, look, I have to say I'm not an expert on taxes, so I don't want to go into this too much, but every country in the world has some form of tax incentives for housing, and as far as I can recall, I don't think the tax arrangements for housing in Australia have changed over the last, you know, for decades, and they're not what's driven this rise in house prices. The rise in house prices was driven by the fact that households were able, due to financial deregulation, to access almost unlimited amounts of credit if they wanted to, and probably even more importantly, the fact that interest rates came down to much lower levels in the through the 1990s than they had been in the 70s and in the 80s. And that just gave households much more borrowing capacity. That's really what drove house prices. I think that the tax situation, whatever it is, it's always been there. I don't think that's really what's caused the current situation. On relation to the iron ore price, well, look, if iron ore prices go down, well, then, you know, there's a whole raft of adjustments will take place. You know, obviously the currency in that environment, that's obviously going to be an environment where the world economy is slowing a lot. We would see the exchange rate go down a long way. Interest rates would respond. All sorts of things would happen. You know, you wouldn't necessarily assume that's going to cause some financial some problem for the Australian economy. The economy would adjust.
Yeah, hello, Rick. Yeah, it's Kai Chow from Sky News Business. You were talking about the global inflation situation. These days, how closely tied is our inflation situation of what they're going through at the moment? So the domestic situation.
Well, I think inflation's always been a global phenomenon. There's, you know, countries do have control over their inflation rate, but the capacity to manage your domestic inflation can be much more difficult in an environment of rising global inflation. We saw that in the 1970s. Even countries like Germany, which are renowned for their low inflation, experienced significantly higher inflation in the 70s. It's impossible to insulate yourself entirely from rising global inflation. All you can do is minimise the flow through to domestic situation. You know, that just makes the whole environment much more difficult. The thing that's changed, I think, is that, you know, for most of the post-war period, the global inflationary cycle was being driven by the US economy. And now we're seeing it being driven mainly by the Asian economy. I think that's a really big difference that's changed.
Sorry, Rick, so you think it's more important that the Asian economy's interest rates than perhaps the rest of the world's to us these days?
Yes, well, the you know, Asian economies are growing very quickly at the moment. Most of them experiencing very rapid rises in asset markets. They've started to raise interest rates, but interest rates in Asia generally remain quite low. And it's that demand from Asia that's driving global demand at the moment.